Good morning. What a beautiful morning. Before I talk about Wise View this morning, I just want to talk about the teachings in general. There's an aspect to any really good, complete teaching that it has a lot of flexibility in it. There are very few things in a teaching that are always true at any moment. A lot of it depends on where you're coming from and what you happen to need to hear at the moment. There are things you can say at an absolute level of realization that would actually be offensive at a different level because we all struggle with things. I know I've heard people I've been a student of say one thing to me and then later turn to somebody else and say something that seems to be really different. And in my head, I'm thinking, wait, that's not what you said to me. And then I realize, oh, the other person had a different need than I do. The historical Buddha did not allow his teachings to be written down during his lifetime, which is interesting because they were verbally memorized for hundreds of years before people felt they could write them down. And I wonder if this was the reason he didn't want them written down, because you hear something and you think that's the absolute truth, and he didn't want that. I mean, my husband was a tennis teacher for years in his 20s, and I think it's probably like you got one student and they hit the ball too high, and so you have them change their grip to make the racket lower, and then the next person they are hitting the net all the time, and so you change their grip in the opposite way. I think it's kind of like that. One way to look at it in the Dharma, which has this flexibility, is there's the mountaintop view and then there's the marketplace view. And I think of the mountaintop are those long-term realizations and awakenings that grow in us in practice. And then the marketplace is our day-to-day lives, the things we struggle with, the things that we continually rub our noses against. Because in the personality level, we're all dealing with conditioning, difficulties, frustrations. And part of having the two views in the Dharma is they're both okay. It's great to have those mountaintop things which do flood down into the marketplace. But it's also totally okay to know, yeah, I see the teachings, but boy, I struggle with it. So that's just the way it is. So part of the Dharma is looking at the places where we feel a little stuck or we feel a little frustrated, like, gosh, I just don't get this. So today I'd like to offer a talk on a traditional Buddhist talk from the marketplace venue. And I'd like to talk about Wise View. In the Eightfold Path, we call it right view, but I think wise view is just a little less baggage. And it's the container for our practice. It's our general outlook and understanding. And the teachings start here because without a wise view, our minds get tumbled every day by all the demands and all of the inputs that are coming at us all the time. Because we get caught in our opinions and our worldview when we don't examine it, we suffer because the world never happens the way our view thinks it should happen, right? Like, oh, things should be this way. People should be honest. Well, guess what? We live in the world where that's not a common view in many circles. And so it's useful to look at our worldview. It's l useful to look at what we believe and how we relate and how tightly we hold it. And because we all have unconscious assumptions and beliefs that we learned at our parents' knees, that when they're unconscious, believe me, 24/7 they are running our lives. They are the sources of many of our triggers. And a lot of this work isn't making them better or feeling more right about them. It's just making all those unconscious views conscious so we can see the biases we live in and hold them a little bit more lightly. So just, it's useful to look at things. So a wise view would be a view that promotes peace, harmony, connection, acceptance of others, being fellow human beings. It would be a wise view, would be a view that decreases suffering, right? In ourselves, in the world. And yet, that seems pretty obvious. I don't, you have to be a karma student to go, yeah, that makes sense. So how come we don't do it? Why is it that so much of the time we're not there? You know, we've all had experiences where things happen and we're clutching, we're clinging, we're fighting, we're arguing, we're complaining. We do that. And those are places where wise view is something we can bring to look at all this stuff we go through. So, you know, how can we hold our experience more lightly? How can we hold our experience with loving kindness? How can we hold it with connection, even when we see people and things that deeply, we feel deeply alienated from, to still hold everyone in the circle of usness rather than othering the things that seem like they bother us or they seem wrong to us? So the first thing is, it's really useful to understand our point of view. Everyone has a vantage point. This just comes from the family we grew up, our DNA, our culture, our gender, our education, all of that stuff, that we have that. We have a particular view of that defines the world for us. That's part of being a human being. In fact, we often call that in these circles our story, right? My story. I'm a wife, a mother. I've done these things. I've had these interactions. I've had, you know. But then we identify with our story, especially our victim stories, you know. And even the most painful story, we hold it dear like it's something precious and we stick to it. For example, there are some people in my life that I've had difficult interactions with. I feel like they've treated me badly, but they treat other people very nicely. And so when I'm with that person, say you're in a work setting with coworkers or a family setting where you're holding this story and you, yeah, but I know this person's really a jerk, you know, and it makes you feel, I mean, when you look at it, it makes you feel isolated. It makes you feel like you're not enjoying the party or the dinner or whatever it is. It's silly to hold that view. And yet there we are, right? Holding on to my hurtness. This is a really interesting thing where it's a human experience. How can wise view give us a hand here? How can it help us out? So the first thing is this understanding that when we commit and identify with a viewpoint, we build a fortress around it. Do you know what I mean here? And in that fortress, we distinguish friends and foes. There are people inside our fortress and there are people outside our fortress. That's not a view that promotes harmony, peace, and lack of suffering. Worth really thinking about that. So in this state, how do we, you know, here we are. How do we find a place that's just more compassionate, that's lighter, that's easier to be with without trying to cut off parts of ourselves or to disown what we're feeling? Because we feel what we feel. So how do we do that without trying to fix or change or edit ourselves in some way that isn't really that freeing? It's just another level of control. How do we do that? So part of it is, in this practice, it's just seeing. We notice and we start to see and engage with the parts of ourselves that are afraid, that build these fortresses because we're afraid. And we start to look at them and just notice them and see them with kindness. And when we start to see our own suffering with kindness, it makes it a lot easier to see other people's limitations as well, does it not? So it kind of starts from the inside out. So when we meditate, what we're really doing is we're noticing all of that play inside us. We're just watching it without fixing, without judging. And this is the keystone that helps us to be open to everything around us. It's the part of the loosening up of our grip on our viewpoint, on our story, on our rightness. And just noticing that, just noticing how this happens in us is an incredibly valuable fruit of our practice. It is what starts us on the Eightfold Path. So I have a Dharma teacher and author who has become a friend of mine. Stephanie Noble is writing a new book, and she gave me her proof of it to read through, which has been a joy. And she has such a great way with words. I just wanted to read a couple of paragraphs that Stephanie wrote about this. And she writes, through the practice of meditation, we may begin to see the patterns of thoughts and emotions. Arising out of the stillness and inner silence, we see our alignments, our attachments, our judgments, our beliefs, everything that we thought made us who we are, become visible in the spacious field of awareness that is infinite and generous. And through this inner exploration, we find in time that we do not have to defend our views. We do not have to hold them so tight as if they were a shield of armor. And we don't have to make someone else wrong or take sides to exist with joy in the world. Spacious view allows us to see the world that is not some stagnant place with a bunch of solid objects bouncing around, banging into each other, but rather we're in a rich web of interconnection. When we begin to notice the web, these inner connections become more alive, more fresh, more wholesome, rather than calcified and rigid with sharp edges that cut and cause significant harm. Isn't that beautiful? So let's talk about right wise view with that preamble. In the traditional way, wise view has three parts, and we sometimes call them the three marks of conditioned experience. And the Pali words, so rarely use a Pali word, but are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And anicca means impermanence. Dukkha is that, well, I'll talk about it in a minute, is that sense of bumpiness or suffering in the world. And anatta means looking for a self, a me, in places where it doesn't really exist. So anicca, impermanence, on one level, it is so obvious. I mean, did you notice the driving conditions this morning were different than what they were last night? And in a way, we're all thinking, well, by tonight, it'll be fine again. That's impermanence. You know, it happens all around us in a flow. And yet, we struggle with it. We worry, mostly on the worrying about losing things that we have. Stability, the things that seem to underlie our quality of life. I used to, and I still occasionally read tarot cards, and there's a tarot card called the Wheel of Fortune. Are you familiar with it? It's actually an image that's in the Dharma too. The wheel, I think it's called the Wheel of Worldly Dharma. And the point is that it's unstable. One minute you're up, the next minute you're down. One minute you're in, the next minute you're out. One minute things are good, the next minute things are crappy and falling apart. And it's that the suffering that comes when you want the wheel to stay in one position and it doesn't. And for an example for me that I have struggled with, and we struggle with this, is we have two sons, and for years we had wonderful camping vacations. And part of it is, you know, when you're camping, there's no phones, there's no computers, there's no TV. You're just sitting around a fire with each other. And there's a lot of great connection that happens. Conversations that wouldn't happen otherwise, you know, that it takes all of us to figure out how to make coffee over a campfire, you know. And I really look forward to that. Well, both of our sons married wonderful women, but neither of these women thinks that having a pit toilet and no running water is a good time. So we have stopped camping. And you know, there's a part of me, I look at the tents in our garage. Every time I look at them, I have this pang of grief. I really miss it. I'm struggling with impermanence here, really struggling. And you know, one of the gifts of just seeing that is it helps us be more open into the present moment. Like right now, we have a beautiful day and we are here together. It's really lovely. I can't think of anything I'd rather do right now. And so, knowing in an hour it's going to be done and we're going to be scattered into the world again really helps me. It can help us just be here in this golden moment that we have. And you know, another thing that gets in the way is of fighting impermanence, if only and when that happens, right? If only this didn't, if only our daughters were woodswomen. Oh, you know, if only, or when this happens. And you know, that's another part of fighting impermanence that takes us away from the now. So, you know, the moment is a flow. There's nothing we can hang on to. We can either fight that or we can relax with it. So the gift of releasing into impermanence is the gift of being more fully alive. And the point of this too, in these conversations, I hope it's dawning on us all, it's not about fixing ourselves. It's not about trying to be better. It's just about seeing how we are, seeing how life is. So the second quality of wise view is dukkha. And dukkha, translated literally, means a wheel in which the axle isn't quite on center. And so as you're going along, everything's bumpy and hurly-burly. And there are two aspects of this that I understand. One is just how life is bumpy. You think you're going to go to the movie and you get a flat tire. You know, you're in the middle of planning this and something breaks or something quits or somebody stands you up in some way. It's just that nature of life that with 8 billion of us out there, it's not going to go our way, right? But there's another aspect of dukkha that has become more and more important to me, and that there's this underlying current of dissatisfaction in our lives. Have you noticed that? Like in moments where you're waiting in line and you're like, how long will this be? When will the line be done? All the times that we're like jumping ahead to some, we're not quite satisfied where we are, so the mind jumps ahead in time or reviews what happens in the past to try to be more comfortable. There's a sense of uncomfortableness that we live with. Do you all know what I'm talking about? And part of this is when you look to outer circumstances, the wheel of fortune, so to speak, for lasting peace and contentment. It's going to disappoint you, but only every single time, which is, in a way, it's a mercy. Dukkha is a mercy because we go through decades of trying to have the right partner, the right job, the right whatever, and everything will be great. When we're on vacation, it'll be great. You know, when we finally realize how much that doesn't work, that's the one thing that finally drives us to where we are, realizing if we want it to be unshakable, it's not in conditioned experience. It's something deep inside us. And here we are connecting with it in this practice. So let's go back into dyads. So while understanding dukkha and impermanence can allow us to release our sense of seeking and looking for something that's going to be the answer and allow us to be more fully enjoying each moment. The last part, anatta, which is looking for a self in places where it doesn't really exist, that really starts to undermine the sense of isolation and separateness that we live in that causes so much fear and suffering. And anatta for me has two parts to it. One is that there's this delusion of separation. And when we think about awakening or realization, fundamentally, it's about waking from that and recognizing it's not true. The second part is that we misidentify who we are with nama rupa, the body, mind, you know, what happens in the body and the mind. So I want to talk about both those aspects. So separation, there's a mountaintop view of, you know, oneness and, you know, the great guru thing. But I'd like to offer a marketplace consideration that might be helpful in just thinking about. So it's the fact that, let's talk about from physics, one of the things that struck me in high school is everything is made up of molecules, atoms, and particles and atoms, right? And when we first learned about that back in high school or college, what struck me is 99.99% of an atom is space. There is nothing there. It's not solid. And yet we look solid. Is that not delusion? Delusion is happening somewhere along the line from atom to me. There's some kind of a disconnect. And, you know, the thing is, too, that, of course, then these particles, these molecules combine to make this myriad of forms. My body, this bell, the snow, the car. How amazing that the stuff that isn't even solid combines in a totally interconnected web that we think of as the physical world. Clearly, that is totally, it's not solid. And the other thing is just as much as these molecules come together to form a cup, in Thich Nhat Hanh's word, this cup is already broken. In some form, at some point, this will be in a landfill and it'll decompose into something different. I mean, I think this is my arm, but who knows, maybe it was part of a T-Rex one, you know, 200 years ago, the same molecules, or it was part of a mountain or a volcano. I mean, ultimately, we are all star stuff. So thinking of ourselves as separate selves with boundaries from just a point of everyday physics isn't really true. There is no separation. We're constantly coming together, breaking apart, even on a matter level. There's nothing that stands alone, especially when you understand impermanence. So, and then on an energy level, this is happening also. There's a constant flow of energy back and forth from form to form, from person to person, from the light to us, to the things in the world that interplay upon each other constantly. In all these kinds of unique patterns. And one of the images of this that I love is Indira's net, which we are all jewels. Everything is like a jewel in a net. And when one jewel moves, the whole net, it's like a spider's web, moves in sympathetic response. So when you think about it, I mean, during the pandemic, Lou and I noticed how even losing just those little day-to-day interactions of people in the grocery line or just driving around people or walking next to them in the sidewalk, how missing that, how much it impacted us. So even the things we don't think about, we're so interconnected, we're so impacted and affected. On an energetic and emotional level, there is no separation. Right? There's no separation. So in terms of being identified with the, you know, we are really, we are literally the force that runs the cosmos. We are star stuff on more than just the physical level. But we express in the portals of these body minds. And the second part of anatta, of looking for a self where it doesn't really exist, is we confuse what we are with the portal we live in these bodies, that sense of the flow of senses, perception, etc. In the Dharma, these are called the five aggregates, and it's understanding the things that we look for a self in, but when we look at them deeply in practice, we realize they are simply flows of experience. The body, I mean, we are in our bodies, but is it this body, or is it the one when I was four, or is it the one that's going to be in 10 years where the mind is falling apart more? The molecules change every 7 years completely, you know, and then we all have experiences where we just are out of our bodies. We understand we are not our bodies. There's the flow of sensory perception, you know, and at a point we realize when you look at something, seeing is probably the hardest one, but just hearing, it's just hearing is happening. There is no one hearing, it's just hearing is happening, but there's no hearer when we look at it deeply. Seeing is happening, but there is no seer. The same thing with our experiences of what we like and what we don't like, the feeling tones of pleasant and unpleasant, all the stuff that happens in the mind. It's just a flow of happening in the mind that we experience. If we were thinking, we would not choose the thoughts we have. I guarantee it. We'd have to be insane. When you start looking at these things deeply in practice, it's clear that thinking is just happening. Feelings are just arising. But there's no permanent self behind there, like the guy behind the curtain on the Wizard of Oz that's pulling the strings. There's no us pulling the strings back there. It's just the strings are being pulled. And even the sense of consciousness that we identify with that seems to blink out when we go to sleep at night and then blink back in, that feels separate. Even in that, when you look at it carefully, it's just a flow of consciousness. There is something deeper in us. It certainly dawned on me that's there 24/7 and watches the mind fall asleep at night. So even the consciousness, which is the hardest one to find, that there isn't really a self in that thing behind our eyes, at a certain point when you look hard for that, you can't find it. It's not there. So the point of all of this, it's not some intellectual, you know, term paper, is that when we start to realize how temporary we are, how there's this interplay physically, emotionally, energetically, that we're just part of that play, that when we see that, it helps us really soften our view. You know, and when we see that in ourselves, we start to see it in everybody. Everybody suffers because they feel separated and they have this illusion of a me behind my eyes and there's an inside and an outside. It opens our heart. It allows us to move through life more freely. So when we attune to this connection and this wholeness, that guides our thoughts and our actions in life in a much more skillful way. So this is going to be our last dyad experience. And I want us to think about, how does your sense of separation and identification affect the way you move through life? How does that know? This, of course, is you got to get it in 2 minutes. So, you know, but, and what's it like in those moments that you feel interconnected and you feel one, maybe just in this community this morning? How does that affect you as well? Okay. One of the things about, hopefully, the conversation I had, the conversations you guys had, is you recognize that we're not looking for answers. Or I started the talk with, there's no hard and fast truth, you know, that it's always going to apply in every situation most of the time. What we're looking for is being one and surrendered to this process we're all in and how messy it is, and being just getting used to it, living with it. And when we see how much we struggle with it, that's the heart of compassion that opens. And it's not berating ourselves or judging ourselves. It's just realizing, yeah, man, it's really rough. There are things that I just have trouble getting my heart around. And the wisdom in that is you recognize we're all there. So the next time the person cuts us off in traffic or we read something, it can still grieve us or annoy us or alarm us, but we can understand it. We can find that our heart doesn't close because of it. And keeping our heart open is really the bottom line value. And the Metta Sutta, which is this beautiful teaching about compassion and kindness, the bottom line is that the whole of the teaching can be said, one should always maintain this recollection, which is the open heart. And when we contemplate the open heart, which is never cutting something out, condemning something, but just noticing how messy and alive all of this is, our hearts don't close. And that's the beginning and the end in one way of this whole teaching. So.